Hey, good morning. My name's Tinica. Sorry to interrupt. I think I just interrupted a wonderful conversation. I'm sorry. I'm glad that you're here. We're very excited to continue our series, the Fruit of the Spirit series. I have a few announcements before we get started, and then Matthew will come up. So for everybody, be sure you pick up a copy of the community flyer. That little brown pamphlet that you got when you came in the door has information about what's happening in the next few weeks and ways to get involved, people to contact if you're interested. Also, if you're new to Cedar Ridge, we especially welcome you here. We're glad that you took time out on Sunday to kind of contemplate things, and we would love to get to know you. So if you are interested, there's two great ways to get to know you better. One, if you're outgoing like me and you want to talk to somebody face-to-face, we do something called Cedar Ridge in 7 minutes. It's back in the back corner right after the service. It'll be a brief introduction to the church. You get to go home with a little something from us, and then you can kind of make face-to-face contact with somebody on staff or the pastoral team. There's another way, too, and this is actually for new and people who've been coming for a long time, but you haven't given us your updated information. On the back of that community flyer, there's something called the Connect Card, and you can fill out your information. We won't put you on any scary list or sell your information, but we can put you in the database, and then you can sign up for the things that you want to know about. So if you're very interested in what's happening with kids here, or if you're looking for more information about the farm, or if you want to be kind of get plugged in more, you can fill in your information and check off in the database what you'd like to do and what you want to hear more information about. Next Sunday, we have a different kind of a worship service. We're still calling it a worship service, but it'll be brief here on the campus, and then we'll send people out for service projects. So we've had a tradition. We usually do it about 3 times a year, in the springtime, in the fall time, and usually one other we kind of squeeze in. We meet here early, so we're coming here at 9 o'clock for breakfast. Everybody kind of brings, just like a family kind of breakfast, everybody brings a little something to share. We eat for about an hour or so, and then we'll have worship here with music. A little prayer to kind of send us off, and then we'll have a number of projects to work on. There'll be a few here on campus, but most of the projects we're going to want people to kind of go out, get out into the community and serve. And so there's lists on the website. That's where we're pointing people. That's what I really like you to sign up for, is on the website. I do have paper signups in the lobby, and you can come talk to me if you're interested or want to hear more specifics about the day and the projects. But if you could, if you want to sign up before next week, is to go to crcc.org and click on the fall day of service, and you can see the full list. Click on something that inspires you and sign up. Bring a friend or a neighbor. People from your D group can work together. It's kind of a great day. So one thing I did want to say, I think that next weekend is the change of time, the fall. Yes, okay, thank you. So make sure that if you're coming that you update your clock so that you don't get here way too early or way too late. But we'd love to have you. I'll be in the lobby for more questions if you have them. As you may have heard, Cedar Ridge is welcoming Brian McLaren. He's our founding pastor. He's going to be coming here for an event. It's November 7th, I believe. The date's not on here. Is it up there? Yay. Monday, November 7th. He's going to be doing a book signing, some readings and discussion about the book. His newest book is called The Great Spiritual Migration. There's information, again, on the website. If you'd like to go, we'd like you to sign up or give us a heads up out in the lobby today so that we can see if we can get a group rate from people from Cedar Ridge. There'll be people coming from all over the area who've kind of connected with Brian and want to see him face-to-face and hear more about his book. And then my last announcement, and then I'll get off the stage. The Racial Reconciliation Team is hosting, they're calling it Crucial Conversations, but they're hosting a discussion on November 12th. It's a Saturday from 9 to noon in the barn, and kind of learning a little bit more how to unpack difficult conversations regarding race. And I think it's pretty valuable because we get into sticky situations sometimes, and it's hard to kind of figure out how to navigate them. So this will be pretty, I think, helpful for all of us. So if you're interested, again, November 12th from 9 to noon in the barn. And then now also, too, just a reminder, if you have a cell phone, because this has happened to me in the past, if you have a cell phone, go ahead and turn it off or put it on buzz so that we can kind of get into this moment for the next hour or so. And then when you're ready, we're going to pray. So I'll do the leader part, and then you can follow along. Gracious God, please center us in your presence this morning. Help us to quiet our busy minds and hearts so that we can focus on you. Open our hearts to your truth, Lord. Teach us to look with honesty and compassion at our shortcomings. Grant us clarity of vision to see the unhealthy patterns and habits in our lives that harm us and others, and give us the courage to change. Free us from any denial or lies that hold us hostage. We want to walk in your truth. Bless us with self-awareness and self-control so that we can be fitting ambassadors for Christ. We trust you to transform us, most merciful God, so that we can reflect your unbounded love in the world. Amen.
Okay, thanks very much. Good to see you, everybody. My name is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here, and we're going to be talking today about a subject called self-control, which is part of our series on the fruit of the Spirit. Just so a quick reminder, we have some material that accompanies this series. We're well over halfway through it now. But if you haven't got a copy of that, I'd encourage you to grab one. You can download one online. I think we still have copies outside in the lobby area. I'm going to reference a few things from the material for this week. You know, we have these messages on Sundays, and then there are discussion questions and different exercises and practices for the week time. Most of those are oriented towards discussion groups, and we have groups here at Cedar Ridge that meet during the week. But even if you're not one of those groups, which is fine, there's some great exercises to do, and as I mentioned, I'm going to refer to a couple of those today. So do grab a copy of that. Let's look at the first of our scriptures for today, which is one we've looked at every time throughout this series. This is where we get this term, the fruit of the Spirit, from. It's in Galatians chapter 5, a letter that one of the early Christian leaders, Paul, wrote to the churches in Galatia. He says, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law." And we're going to be talking today about that last one on the list, self-control. We've not taken these in order, so we're not at the end of the series. But I think the next two we're going to do. Tina can mention next week we're taking a little break and we're going to go out and serve our community. So that's, you know, as much an important part of what we do together as anything we're going to do today. But the week after that, we'll touch on faithfulness. And these two, self-control and faithfulness, I think in many respects kind of look back on all the other fruit qualities. If you like, self-control could be viewed as how do we live our life in line with the kind of things we've been talking about over the last few weeks, love and joy and peace and patience and kindness. How can we be controlled in that kind of manner? Same with faithfulness, we might say, faithfulness is about how do we go on living like that? How do we commit to that? How do we make that a regular part of our lives? How do we make that the norm? The final week, by the way, of the series is going to be on gratefulness. That will lead us into thanksgiving, which isn't one of the qualities that's in that those couple of verses. But, you know, we've said all along, we don't think this is an exhaustive list. And I think we've probably seen already that there's lots of overlap between these qualities. So, you know, we've got to be careful about being too definitive. And the journey goes on, right? There's lots of qualities to our spirituality that we want to engage in and participate in and pursue. So, you know, it's not like that's going to end with this list or end with this series. A couple of things about self-control before we sort of dive into it I want to mention. The first one is this, that I think there's a tendency and perhaps a danger even with this particular subject matter for us to fall back into the we've just got to try harder, we've got to do better, perhaps feeling guilty, feeling shameful about certain things going on in our lives. Because, you know, as we're going to find out, I think, we're all out of control in various ways, right? And none of us exhibit self-control perfectly. So there's things in our lives that are out of control. It's going to be fine because we can keep those to ourselves for now, okay? So no worries there. But we're going to try and be at least honest with ourselves about this. And that the tendency then can be, we just need to do better, right? And we've said all along, and in fact, the whole tone of this letter that Paul is writing is not about just trying harder, not about guilt, not about shame as a motivator. It's about engaging with the positive Spirit of God in our lives and letting that motivate us and drive us to a different, more healthy, more wholesome, more productive kind of life, okay? So let's not, whatever we think about this subject this morning, whatever I say, let's remember this is not about guilt. This is not about shame. The other thing I would say about it is I think that we often view self-control, particularly in in a religious setting like ours, we often view self-control as kind of all about what we shouldn't do, right? It's all about a restrained life, if you like, about don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other. You know, and that tends to be kind of the mantra of religion, right? It's about negative very often, or it can be. But let's look at the same verses that we just looked at in a different translation from the original language, the Greek. And this is a much more modern translation. We use it frequently here. It's called the Message. It's still based on the original manuscripts. It's still making a very good attempt to give a true meaning. It's just using more modern language. Here's what it says. But what happens when we live God's way? He brings gifts into our lives much the same way that fruit appears in an orchard. Things like affection for others, exuberance about life, serenity. We can probably recognize some of the fruit qualities that we've been talking about previously. We develop a willingness to stick with things, a sense of compassion in the heart, and a conviction that a basic holiness permeates things and people. We find ourselves involved in loyal commitments, not needing to force our way in life, and able to marshal and direct our energies wisely. Okay, so that ending part there, able to marshal and direct our energies wisely, that has a very positive connotation, right? So self-control, which is that's the translation of self-control, the word in the original Greek is egrateia, it's been translated here in a much more positive way. I think self-control is positive, but what I'm saying, I guess, is we have connotations with it that tend to be negative. What self-control is all about is living a productive life. It's about being who we really want to be. It's about fulfilling all our potential as human beings, as loving, kind, patient human beings, right? It's about all of that rather than about what we shouldn't be doing. Now, we also know, of course, that things get in the way of us being those kind of people. Things get in the way of us being who we want to be, right? We have different weaknesses and issues going on in our lives that have at times formed into habits or patterns that hold us back. Some of those are really obvious, at least to other people. Some of them are not so obvious. So it certainly involves looking at issues that are inhibitive to us, but we've got to bear in mind that this is about setting us free to live life and live it to the full, as Jesus talked about. So let's bear those two things in mind. No guilt, and this is about freedom and really living life rather than about being restrained or suppressed. Okay, I mentioned the word egrateia. The word egrateia means, it has this sense of mastery, of discipline, of strength. Okay, so it's a very positive word that is translated self-control. Let's look at a couple of instances where this same writer, Paul, uses it in another letter that he wrote to the church in Corinth. The first one says this, do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Okay, so he's using the same language there for self-control. Now, he's using a metaphor of athletics, of running. I mean, Paul uses a lot of metaphors, and like all metaphors, sometimes they break down eventually, right? You know, I mean, I think there's good and bad ways of looking at the spiritual journey as a race. Anyway, we won't get into that. But what he's saying there is be positive with your life, train your lives, be disciplined, be strong in the way that you live. And there's this sort of athletic, positive connotation that we've just been talking about this term. He also uses it in the other context of being more careful and dealing with issues in our lives that are inhibitive or problematic. In 1 Corinthians 7, he says this, now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, and by the way, this is a little bit of patriarchy coming through here, so we just have to bear with that, but to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. What he means is he doesn't want people having illegal sex all over the place, you know, so that's his way of dealing with that. But the point he's getting at here is that there are issues in our lives that kind of can get out of control, right? Sexuality is one of those, right? I can think back to a time in my life where I would say I was out of control sexually. And it wasn't a positive thing. It seemed positive at the time, but it was... Who's laughing there? I can hear someone chuckling to themselves. I'm talking about a really dark period of my life. Anyway, but it was pretty destructive. And I think we can all relate to that. Maybe not necessarily sexually, probably. But we can think about patterns and urges and habits and behaviors in our life that can be somewhat out of control, right? Let me share an example of one of these with you. I think if we could put up the next slide. And I'm realizing now that I shouldn't have just said anything about sexuality just now, because you're going to get all the kind of wrong impression about what I'm about to say. But did you know it's the 20th anniversary of Tomb Raider coming out? Anybody ever played Tomb Raider before? Oh, my gosh. Am I? Okay, well, we're going to get into confession later on, okay, as part of this issue of self-control. This is the only video game I ever played, Tomb Raider 2. I didn't even play the first one, but thank you for those of you who did put your hand up. But it's apparently the 20th anniversary of Tomb Raider 1. 1997, I was living in Cincinnati, working in a church, and you know, busy, great experience, but very busy, quite a stressful kind of job. And unlike this one, which is a piece of cake. No, not really, at all. But... And I was getting kind of pretty anxious, pretty stressed out. So my lovely wife, Lisa, bought me a PlayStation. It was the first kind of PlayStations. And with the PlayStation came Tomb Raider 2. Now, I didn't think too much of it, despite the cover. I didn't really think too much. I just thought, oh, it's one of those video games. I won't be too much. But she thought playing a video game might help me kind of just have some relaxation, that kind of thing. It opened up a whole new world to me. This was like Dungeons and Dragons on steroids. And I know you all played Dungeons and Dragons, okay? I'm not even going to ask you about that. Because it's, anybody played Dungeons? Yes. Well, this was like, you had to problem solve. You got into a new scenario, and all these things would just open up. And to me, and this is 1997, the graphics were amazing. Obviously, compared to today, not the case. But the trouble was, this thing that was meant to help me relax became an obsession. And my wife would have to come down at like 3 a.m. and peel my hands off the controller. And bear in mind that it took me about a month to work out that you could save. I didn't realize you could save. So I'd just go all the way back to the beginning again when I got killed. And then somebody said, hey, you can get a memory stick. You know that? And I was like, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. So I went out and got a memory stick. And it became a problem. Actually, I think, here it is. I have a copy of my original Tomb Raider 2 game. It's probably worth a lot of money now. But even though I still have it, I gave it up. I finished it first. I finished the whole thing. But then I just decided I cannot play these games. I can't do that. You know, I was 30 or so at the time, and I felt like a teenager or something. I just could not do that. Plugged into something in me that was out of control, right? Some of you may be able to relate to that around video games. You may be able to relate to it around other issues. You know, we have these things in our lives that aren't necessarily wrong. We can take that image down, by the way. Yeah, it's kind of a show. Thank you. They may not necessarily be wrong, but they kind of take over, right? And they become an obsession, or they become something that begins to govern our life or take up way too much time. If we stop and think about it, it's like we don't really want to be like that. We don't want to spend all that time on those things, or we don't want to react that way, or we don't want to respond that way. But it kind of feels like a pattern. It's just part of us now, right? We all wrestle and struggle with those kind of things, right? It seems like that's a normal part of our life. Now let's talk then about what can be out of control in our life. Let's think about some of the lack of control. Before we go there, I just want to mention that what we are not talking about today is suppressing our emotions or suppressing our reactions. Again, this isn't about guilt or shame. It's not about, I don't think we should be thinking about self-control as repression of feelings, repression of actions. Let's look at a verse, actually. Again, the writer Paul, in a letter he wrote to Ephesus, he wrote a lot of letters, this guy, he says this: therefore, each of you must put off falsehood, don't be fake, in other words, and speak truthfully to your neighbor, For we are all members of one body. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. So there's something he's talking about there, anger. Some of us might have a problem with anger, right? Again, we won't do a show of hands, but probably I would imagine most of us have experienced anger that's got a bit out of control, right? Where we've reacted more strongly than we really wanted to, or in a way that's surprising to us. For some of us, that might be a real struggle. It might be a pattern, something we're trying to wrestle with and deal with. There's nothing wrong with anger. That emotional response of anger is a normal, natural response. It can become toxic, it can become negative, okay? So he's giving people permission to get angry. And he's saying, that's not sinning. And he's saying, don't be fake. In other words, he's saying, if you're angry, it's probably better to express it, but there's ways of expressing it, right? And there's not letting the sun go down on your anger, not letting anger persist, but resolving it. And there's healthy ways of dealing with anger. This is not a message about anger per se, so we're not going to dig too deep into that. But the point being, it would be a big mistake for us to go away with this message of self-control and start trying to suppress all these feelings. That's not what it's about. In fact, perhaps that's as much about as what it means to be out of control, right? When you think about some of us, right, are very expressive and we have emotion reactions. And the negative side of that, it's not hard for us to express our emotions. The negative side of that is that our, life can become all about us and how we're feeling and how we're doing, and our emotions spill out in every situation and have a negative impact on other people. We need self-control. But on the other hand, for some of us, it's like life's all about us and we're not going to be out of control and we're going to remain safe and secure in our reactions by being very buttoned down. And that has a very negative impact on everybody else because they don't know where we're coming from. They don't really know whether we care. They don't know. There's not an interact with us. We need more self-control to let ourselves go, to be our true selves, right? So it works both ways. And suppression of these things is as much a negative aspect of self-control or lack of self-control as all these other things that, are spilling out of us. Okay, so, we'll be in different places as regards that equation, but let's not come away from this pushing emotions down. That's not what we're talking about here. Well, what are we talking about? I want us just to go back to the passage from the beginning, from Galatians 5, where Paul is talking about the fruit of the Spirit. Before that, he talks about what we might call the anti-fruit, or the product of living a life that's not full of God's Spirit. Okay, so this is the dark side. Oh, it's up there already. So here's what it says. The acts of the flesh, that's his metaphor for the opposite of spirit. The acts of the flesh are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity, and debauchery. That's a great word there, isn't it? Anybody into debauchery? I mean, who's going to confess to that one, right? I mean, who's going to... idolatry and witchcraft, those first few might be trickier for us to kind of relate to. Hatred, we can relate to hatred, right? And sort of hate rising up in us and reaction. Discord, jealousy, that's one that kind of wells up within us. And that fits of rage, we kind of touched on that. Selfish ambition, where our selfishness and our competition kind of takes over and we put people down and we make decisions that could have put us ahead rather than other people. Dissensions, factions, and envy, drunkenness, orgies. Anybody? For orgies? Anyone who comes up? And the like. I love the way he ends with that. There you go. That's another one, like with the fruit of the Spirit, we said there's no end to it. Well, there's no end to this list. Now, let's look at it again in the Message version. We did that with the fruit of the Spirit. And it's sort of more modern language. Humor aside, let's just begin to reflect a little bit on what might be some of the things out of control in our own life. Could we put the Message version of that one up? So let's just sort of reflect on this. Some of these, that previous list in the New International Translation I just read may have triggered some things for us. This same list in different language might trigger some other things. It is obvious what kind of life develops out of trying to get our own way all the time. That's how he describes the life of the flesh, getting our own way all the time. Repetitive, loveless, cheap sex. A stinking accumulation of mental and emotional garbage. Frenzied and joyless grabs for happiness. Trinket gods, magic show religion. I think he's saying that We can kind of be addicted to religion there. Paranoid loneliness, cutthroat competition, all-consuming yet never satisfied wants, a brutal temper, an impotence to love or be loved, divided homes and divided lives, small-minded and lopsided pursuits, the vicious habit of depersonalizing everyone into a rival, uncontrolled and uncontrollable addictions, ugly parodies of community. I could go on. Okay, so when we think about these things, and you know, that list isn't specifically around the issue of self-control, but I think as we read that list, we begin to connect with some of the things that are out of control in our lives, the kind of things that are out of control in our lives. Let's think about patterns, behaviors, urges, tendencies, addictions, where we're responding a way we either don't want to respond, or we're responding in a way that maybe we kind of do want to respond, but we know it's not healthy. We know it's not right, either for us or for other people. And responses where we find it really hard to stop that response. And that may be because we just don't care, or it might be because we do care and we've tried, but these things have become so ingrained in our lives that we can't help it. Now, some of those things, right, are really obvious things, and they're to do with physical stuff like sex, food, drink, all kinds of things that we can become addicted to or have bad behavior with, toxic behavior with. And those things are perhaps more obvious. Now, the tricky thing with those is obviously they tend to be rooted in something much deeper, something more emotional, something more psychological, something more spiritual. But they tend to be the sort of things that we see more readily. But there's also many things that are just psychological or emotional about our lives that represent an equal lack of self-control. They can be things like fear, anxiety, anger, some of these things that we've been looking at on that list, conflict or avoidance of conflict, insecurity, jealousies, all those things that kind of rise up in us and respond, insecurities that kind of lead us to behave a certain way or prevent us from behaving a certain way. And these things tend to be more relational, right? They tend to impact our relationships. Not that the other things, the more physical type things, don't, but these ones really kind of rear their ugly head in the relational context, and very often it's not until we hit crisis in relationship that we realize we've got to do something about this because we get feedback from somebody or somebody distances themselves from us. And that's true, I think, in some of our, you know, in our family relationships, in our friendships. It's true also in our work life. That's the whole basis of all the research into emotional intelligence, right? It's like we may be very well qualified to do our job or very well trained and have all sorts of skills, but it's the emotional things that often get in our way, our insecurity, our anger, our fear and our jealousy, and all those things that work themselves out in a work setting that inhibit our ability to lead, or inhibit, in other words, as we were saying at the beginning, our ability to be free to really fulfill our potential and really fulfill what we're about, or to reach that goal, or to accomplish that thing that we're trying to do, be it at work or be it in a relationship. So these things are very real. They're very real. And they're tricky. They're so tricky because mostly they're a bit embarrassing, right? We have, as I mentioned at the beginning, we have a lot of shame around these things because it sucks to be out of control, right? We don't want to acknowledge that we're not in control is acknowledging weakness, and we have a lot of shame around these things, and also very often our lack of self-control, the things that we're doing, our reactions, our responses, are busy triggering everybody else's responses around us. So it's a real mess. And in that mess, the last thing we want to do is be vulnerable and say, hey, everybody, I've got a problem. I just want to say I've got a problem. And we don't want to do that kind of thing. So we get stuck, right? Because by definition, we can't pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We can't change ourselves. We're stuck in these patterns of behavior. And we can feel somewhat lost and hopeless in those situations. Now, we're going to talk about, okay, what can we do about this in a second. I just wanted to share with you another example of lack of self-control on my part. This isn't a funny one. Or you might think it's funny, but it's not funny to me. And that is, like, I pick my thumbs, right? I have this habit that I'm really ashamed of picking my thumbs. And that photo went up already, so it's up there. Now, I am so ashamed of it that I most of the time I hide my thumbs. I don't like people looking at my thumbs. I feel so embarrassed about it. And actually, I sent this photo in to be made for a slide, and the person who got it said, "Oh, that's really gross. What is that about?" And I said, "There, you see, that's why I don't talk about it." So when I was, I don't know what happened, when in my teenage years, I just got into this habit of picking my fingers, right? And some of you may be, or my thumbs, some of you may have noticed that. It's related to anxiety and all sorts of internal things. And by the way, I'm just confessing something here. I'm not asking for therapy from anybody right after. So I know there are things I can do and all the rest of it, but just want to put that boundary down there, you know, right? But I have this problem, and it started in my teenage years. I can remember sat on a train when I was 17 or 18, and I was about to go to medical school, right? So I went to medical school in England. We go at 18 over there, and you're at medical school for 6 years. And I was thinking, oh, this is really bad, because the whole medical establishment had this really big thing about hands, understandably. And I thought, I can't keep doing this while I'm at medical school, because sometimes I'll make them bleed and that kind of stuff. So I thought, I'm going to stop before I go to medical school. And of course, I carried on at medical school. Then it was like, oh, I'll stop, you know, when I'm 30. And I haven't stopped. Right? I haven't stopped. It's an ongoing challenge. Now, the reason I mention that, or I'm sharing this, is one, because I'm as big a loser as anybody else in the room, right? I just want to make that point. I haven't got my life all together. And also, you might be thinking, that's not a big deal. But I'm really ashamed of my thumbs, right? It was the way I was brought up. My family had a big thing about thumbs, you know, and it was ingrained into me, you've got to have great thumbs. I'm joking now. I'm joking. I don't know what all that those shame issues are associated with, but I don't want people to look at my thumbs. So I'm putting pictures of my thumbs up here to prove that it's safe, right? It's safe, actually, to come out and say, I've got a problem. I may be embarrassed about this. I may feel ashamed of it. Very often, the things that we're ashamed of, everybody else is thinking, you're ashamed of that? I'll give you 10 other things you should be ashamed about, right? And you're probably thinking the same thing now. It's like, thumbs is only the beginning, let me tell you. But it's actually safe to come out, right? And that's one of the things that we're going to talk about in an atmosphere of love in a moment. But we all have, we can take that down now. Please can you take that down? We all have these challenges. We all have issues going on in life. And that, you know, the grand scheme of things, probably that is not the biggest problem in the world, right? But I have other issues in my life that are much more incapacitating. So we have these challenges. We've got to just open our hearts up to them. We've got to be honest with ourselves, got to face them. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But before we go there, I want to just look at Jesus for a moment. Because we've talked about what out of control might look like. Well, in the material today for this week, there's an opportunity for us to reflect on what's out of control in our own life. But there's also an opportunity to reflect on some scriptures that talk about the kind of control that Jesus exhibited. And again, it's not this restrained, restrictive, religious control. It's beautiful life that Jesus lives. Let me give you some examples of that. There's multiple passages that talk about Jesus setting his face towards Jerusalem. But there's this internal resolve in Jesus' life that despite his emerging understanding of what's going to happen to him in Jerusalem, namely death, he sets his face there. And so he has this destiny, he has this mission, he has this purpose, and he has the internal motivation to stay true to it. We see that also when he's tempted, right? He's in Matthew 4, he's tempted in the desert, and he has this resolve because he knows what he's about. I long for that kind of resolve. I long for that kind of control. That doesn't seem restrained or negative to me. That seems beautiful and productive. We also see Jesus acting in measured ways or giving himself space. So in John chapter 2, Jesus goes in and clears the temple of all the money changers, right? That story is told in pretty much all the Gospels in different ways. In John chapter 2, it talks about him going in there, looking around, and then he goes off and he weaves a whip together. He makes a whip. And there's this sort of almost contemplative exercise he goes through, so that when he starts getting angry and clearing people out, there's something very measured about it. It's not an out-of-control reaction, right? There's something measured about it. We see that also when a woman caught in adultery, a woman is dragged from her bed. I mean, she's got to be naked, and she's thrown in front of Jesus as a test for him. What's he going to do? Is he going to judge her and comply with the law, or is he going to forgive her and apparently break the law? And Jesus is there writing in the sand. And there's lots of theories about what is Jesus writing, why is he writing, but at least one of them seems to be that he's just taking his time, he's biding his time. There's other, you know, sort of more heavy-duty analysis of that, but Jesus seems to be, I'm not going to be forced into a reaction right now. And much of the time we react instinctively to situations, and that's what gets us into trouble. You can look at some of these in the workbook this week. Another one, for instance, where Jesus is encouraged. This is in John chapter 7. He's encouraged by his brothers, his family. Hey, Jesus, go to Jerusalem. He's in Nazareth and Galilee and that era. They're saying, go to Jerusalem, Jesus, because you are a star, and they're going to make you king. I mean, if you've got, look at these miracles, look at all the crowds that are following you. You need to go and set up your kingdom. Go to the capital. Go to Jerusalem. So Jesus' ego is tempted. It's like, how often do we make decisions because of our own insecurity or our own desire for fame, fortune, or whatever, or just to be accepted, just to be liked? Our reactions to situations often come out of that, and Jesus resists it. Now, he ends up going to Jerusalem anyway for other reasons, but he's not just pushed around by those issues in his life. He's in control. Again, something very attractive, something very beautiful about the way Jesus is. So I encourage you, again, even if you're not in a group discussion this week, just grab a copy of the material and look at some of those, reflect on some of those scriptures, and reflect a little bit on areas in our own lives where we may feel out of control. Now let's get back for a second to ways in which we can respond to this conundrum. I was talking earlier about feeling kind of trapped in this prison of control, or where things are controlling us rather than us controlling ourselves. And a lot of that is around secrecy and fear and shame and all that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to share some things that we can do. So I'm just going to share three things. And these are, let me say, you know, these are not foolproof techniques to overcome the problem of self-control, right? Let me say this, that I think these are things that if we did more of this, these three things, if we did more of this, we would be more like Jesus. We would, over time, be more in control. We would, over time, live more healthy, wholesome lives. Okay, so these are not foolproof. They're not like instant responses. There's going to be, these three things are not going to make me any money out of a book or anything like that. You know, the three irrefutable ways to overcome the lack of self-control. These are, I think, just pretty normal things. I'm going to share what those three things are in a second. Let me also say this. I think there are things in our lives that are inconveniences, right? Let's call them that. Or they're problems. They're not crippling. There are other things in our lives that feel crippling, where we feel at a dead end, where maybe we've been working at things for years and we've not seen any progress, or we've not seen the kind of progress we need. And this might be addictive behaviors, could be really damaging behaviors, damaging to ourselves, damaging to relationships. Let me say that in those situations, I think it's really clear. We need 12-step programs, we need therapy, and we live in a culture where those things are readily accessible to us. So in all these things I'm going to say, it's not a substitute for going and getting the help that we need, okay? And I would say the same thing if somebody came to see me and said, I'm having chest pain when I exercise. I wouldn't say, well, let's talk about that. Let's have I would say, you need to go and see a doctor because that sounds like there's a problem with your heart, okay? So we are very fortunate in our culture that we have access to all kinds of help. let's take full advantage of that help. But I think these three things are going to even help us as we reach out for more help. Those three things are this: love, which we have said is the root of all this fruit that we've been talking about these past few weeks. Love. The other one is honesty. And then the other one is letting go. Let's just unpack these a little bit, and then we'll wrap up. So the first one, love. Okay, love has to be the beginning of self-control. The root of self-control is love. Let me explain what I mean by that. Let's think about, we feel judged, right? We are afraid of being judged, and we are probably judging ourselves. We beat ourselves up about these areas of lack of self-control. What if we could totally accept the fact that God loves us completely, in all our weakness, in all our frailty, in all our ugliness, as well as all our beauty and all the other wonderful things? But we tend to home in on those, the ugliness, right? The only place we can move from here is in an atmosphere of love, right? If we don't have an atmosphere of love, then we're going to hide away, and we're going to be fearful, and because that's the opposite of love. And that will not lead to healing. So some of what we need to do is receive God's love. We're going to do a little exercise in a moment to help us a little bit with that. And again, there's information in the workbook this week about working on some of those things. Okay? So we need to experience love. We need to experience God's complete, unconditional love. We need to love ourselves. I think that's very closely related to receiving God's love. As we receive God's love, as we realize, whether we, you know, for some of us that's a very personal thing, and we have a very personal image of God, or whether it's a more general sense of the love of the universe, if you like, whatever that is for us, as we begin to experience that, we begin to accept ourselves more, and we are able to love ourselves more. And loving ourselves can be hard if we're beating ourselves up, right? So as we love ourselves, even with the problems that we have, things can begin to change. We can also, it's also loving ourselves to do something about these areas in our lives that are out of control. One of the most loving acts we can do for ourselves is to start some change, right? And to address it, because our lives would be better. We would get to be our true self. We would get to live our life to the full. That's doing ourselves a big favor, a big favor. And then thirdly, it's loving other people, right? Because as we change, life gets a lot better for the people around us. And that's, so we're making a loving contribution to the world. So love is where it starts, right? If we can begin from an atmosphere of love, then perhaps change is possible. The second thing was honesty. And I think this is really tricky for us for reasons we've mentioned already. But I love the 12-step approach to a searching, fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Again, don't want to keep plugging the material, but there's an opportunity in the material, actually in the discussion. Again, we could do that with ourselves or with somebody else if we're in a group, but there's an opportunity to take some time out and to think seriously about our lives, fearlessly, in an atmosphere of love, and privately. And just to make an inventory of, okay, what needs to change? What is out of control? What are some of these urges that I don't seem to be able to, that seem to have control over me, or patterns of behavior, or addictions, addictive behaviors in my life? You know, to look at them and label them and just put them down, right? Being really honest with ourselves, I think, is a huge challenge. But in an atmosphere of love, we can do that. And then the other part of honesty is being honest with one another. Now, that's perhaps where it gets even more tricky. And we think about the issue of confession, about saying to somebody else, I have this problem. And there's an opportunity. This is not going to be pushed or pressured at all. But in the group setting, in the workbook material, there's an opportunity to share one of those areas that we've written down with another person and have that person share back with us about their situation and pray for one another. But, you know, I've talked before here about the power of confession, the power of getting things out into the open. And that doesn't mean telling everybody. You know, I mean, there's trusted relationships in which we do this kind of thing, right? But we have this opportunity in a community like this to share with one another about what we're struggling with. Again, I know I've mentioned this before, but I have struggled a lot and still to a fair degree struggle with social anxiety, which can at times lead to panic attacks. That's another thing. You can probably get the pattern of anxiety in my life, okay? Thumbs, all that sort of stuff. One of the hardest things I ever did in my life was actually tell somebody that I had that problem. Because it was causing all kinds of wreaking havoc, actually, and I had to talk about it. As I talked about it, something of the power of it seeped away. You know, it lost its power by just sharing it. And many of the things in our lives have power over us because they're so secret and they just intimidate us. And then when we get it out and look at it, it's like, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid. And we share it with somebody else, and they're not afraid. And they don't think we're a complete weirdo. So just the act of confession, this atmosphere of honesty, sets us on the right path. So it's love, it's honesty, and then it's letting go. Okay. And so there's some practical things I think we can look at here about what does letting go mean. Now, we've said throughout the series that it's not just about trying harder and more effort and all those kind of things. I mean, clearly, effort is required. But there's this issue of letting go and surrendering to the Spirit of God. I think perhaps the greatest mystery in the universe is how do we partner with the divine? How do we allow the Spirit of God, this divine Spirit, to work with our humanity such that we become transformed? I mean, it's an easy thing to talk about, but how does that happen? And we've got... Throughout this series, we've talked about different practices, different things we can do to make more room for God, right? To make room for God. So we'll talk about that. Let me just give three things I think that can be helpful to us in this letting go. So we've got, you know, love of God, self, and others, and an atmosphere of honesty with ourselves and with others. And then we've got letting go, and there's kind of three aspects to letting go, I think. One is this: letting go means just saying, accepting that we are weak. There's something really powerful about just saying, okay, I have a problem. I have a problem. And I'm going to live with that problem. I'm going to acknowledge that problem. I'm not going to try to hide it away. I'm not going to try and suppress it. I'm going to do some things that are going to hopefully lead me to being more to being more whole and healthy. But I'm not going to fake it anymore. And I'm just going to live with this problem. I'm going to live in vulnerability. And that's hard, because once we accept that, sounds very beautiful, but once we accept it and once we accept that weakness, then we have to do something about that weakness, right? And many of us, and I would include myself in this, I have all kinds of compensation mechanisms, right? For the areas in my life that are out of control, I have learned to put sort of barriers around them so that either it's not too obvious or I can manage people's responses to me. You know, like if I get really angry or really anxious, I kind of manage the situation, and I begin to feel secure about my management strategies. And that's where my safety is. Now, stuff happens and it all falls apart, and I can build the wall up again. But we have these management strategies, right? And we begin to feel secure in those things. And that's a place that's going to keep us in toxicity. To break those walls down and just to be is really challenging. But I think that's something we can do in an atmosphere of love, in an atmosphere of honesty. So just even sort of consciously saying, I'm going to be vulnerable about this. I'm going to accept the fact that I'm not perfect, that I have weakness, that I have these struggles. And the second thing is making space for ourselves. Okay, making space for ourselves. We can do things, I think, that are going to help us in these automatic responses to situations. For instance, sometimes we might need to just walk away or stay away, not go to certain places. There may be certain things, situations that we're better off just not going to, you know, and we might be able to think of that, especially around some sort of physical habits around drink and food and sex and that kind of thing. You know, just creating space and not having certain things accessible to us, that might be a good thing to do. But there's also this making space and making room for ourselves that we can do where, I think of the sort of thing we often teach our kids about counting to 10 before we respond to something, right? It sounds so cliched and so simple, but we all have these huge reactions to things that decay exponentially, right? I think we've got a graph of exponential decay. Maybe we can put that graph up. It's not quite exponential, but if you think about, let's suppose on this axis, on the horizontal axis is time, and on the vertical axis is our reaction to something. And we could think here about anger or envy or hatred or whatever it is, you know, sort of emotional responses that we tend to struggle with. Most of the time, okay, we want to react about here, okay? And that's when, especially in our current age of text, email, social media, right? We get it, somebody says something to us or sends something to us, and we've made our lives way more complicated now because we can respond immediately. And this is the point where we usually choose to send the email, right? About here, where it's, you know, a few minutes or seconds after we've had this reaction. By the time we get here, which may be hours later or days later, we're laughing about it, right? We just, oh, I felt so angry about that situation. And it's no longer really a big deal to us. So some of our, and I think that this exponential decay happens really quickly. I think it can happen over seconds. Right? We respond to something rather than just thinking, getting in the habit of not responding, of taking a moment, maybe breathing or counting, or maybe it's walking away or whatever. We can find different things that work for us just to give ourselves space. It's being kind to ourselves, because this is the spot, this is the point when we get into all kinds of other problems. Here, we respond, and our response triggers everybody else's lack of self-control, and then we've got mayhem, right? And we've all experienced that, right? We've all experienced that to various degrees. So this just seems like this is the nature of reality. And we every single one of us have things that hurt us or cause a reaction in us that we now laugh about because of one factor, time. The issue may not have even got resolved, but we just, over time, we just don't, yeah, it's not that big a deal, you know. It's just that here it is. So creating space for ourselves, and that might be creating space for the spiritual practice, for instance. It might be we would think about some of the practices we've been looking at throughout this series. Maybe doing a breath prayer or something in those moments that can just help us center ourselves. Maybe it's like one of the things I had in a time when I was particularly anxious. I had a statement memorized, which was a positive statement that I would say to myself in certain situations that helped me recenter, helped me refocus. Okay, so we have situations examples where we need to give ourselves space. And then the third one is giving God space, right? Giving God space. So we talk about this. We can take that down now. Thank you. We talk about this a lot here, is like putting the pressure on God, right? We could put all the pressure on ourselves for these issues, or we could lean on to God and say, God, I need you to show up. I need your help in this situation. And opening ourselves up to more of God's Spirit, to more of this life that Paul is talking about in the book of Galatians and in most of the letters he writes, he's talking about this way of life where we experience the Spirit of God living inside us, dwelling within us, that's transforming us. It's this divine partnership. There's all sorts of metaphors used to try and describe it because it's such a hard thing to describe. So how can we make more space for God in our lives? And that's, I think, really what we've been looking at throughout this whole series. And you can look back through this series, you know, again, grab a copy of the workbook, look at some of the practices we've been talking about that are really our effort to make room for God. Okay, so it's not our effort to just do better. It's our effort to make space in which God can work within us. And there are, we talk about spiritual practices here quite a lot, but we've talked about several in this series. So I'd encourage you to, there's some in the material this week that I think could be helpful. And there's even a reflection on a long passage in the book of Romans, where Paul talks about this very thing, about experiencing God's life in us. But there's other ways where we can just open our hearts up and experience God. And I think was it Melanie last week? You gave a guarantee, didn't you, Melanie? Something about, you know, what was the guarantee again? 12 minutes a day in silence, you'll see positive changes in your life, or your money back, right? I think that's the thing. So go to Melanie for all your refunds. But this is something that we can do, okay? Something that we can do. So we're going to do just practice some of that right now. We're just going to try and experience God's love this morning. So I just want to encourage us all to close our eyes. There's nothing. Nobody's going to touch anybody or steal anything off anybody, right? So let's just close our eyes, and as we often do here, we're just going to focus on our breathing, okay, as a way of centering ourselves. And I'm just going to guide us through this, so I'm going to say a few things, but all we have to do is be silent and receive. So, Holy Spirit, I just invite you here now. Come, Holy Spirit. And in this quietness, as you breathe in and out, just breathe in God's complete unconditional love. So just get into the rhythm of breath that is very normal for us. And as we breathe in God's complete love. And as you breathe out, just let go of fear, anxiety, every contradiction, things that say, yeah, but what about this thing going on in your life? That's not a reason to be loved, etc., etc. All this, let's just let those go with the out-breath. So just breathe in God's love and let go of fear and darkness with the out-breath. And as you are in this place, in this moment, just turn your attention towards one or two or whatever things in your life that you feel are out of control. Stuff you may have thought about this morning. Maybe you have to dig around a little bit, or maybe it's just really obvious. It's just right there. Don't judge yourself. It just is. We're in this moment. So you don't have to give an excuse for the past. You don't have to predict the future. You're just here right now with what is. There's no blame. Holy Spirit, come and see us. Look at us. And as you reflect on those things, as you maybe name those things or just identify them, invite God's love into them. Okay, so don't hide them away, but just let God see them. And they may be embarrassing, they may be things that have been there for ages, there may be things that you've only just thought of, but let God see them. Let God's Spirit come to those things. And continue to breathe in God's love and God's acceptance, that God accepts you with all those things, that you are desperately loved. Those things do not repel God. They do not diminish God's love in any sense. And that feels uncomfortable. We want to justify somebody loving us or liking us. We want to earn it. We want to own it. We want to deserve it. So be vulnerable. okay to be loved. Lord, let your love sink deep into our hearts, our minds, our souls, our emotions, our psyches, all the words we grasp for to talk about who we really are. Let your love dispel fear as we breathe you in. Now, we're going to have a time of communion together. I want to encourage you to stay in that place, right? And I want to encourage us all, myself included, to go to that place regularly, right? That's so simple. There was nothing particularly miraculous about that, right? We're just saying, okay, I'm going to sit with my weakness and receive God's love. But if we could learn to live out of that place of love and acceptance, things would begin to change. Things would begin to change quite considerably, I think. So there's a simple practice of us just receiving something. This morning, we're going to take communion, right? Communion, we've got gluten-free bread and wine at the front here and in the middle, and then you can be served at the sides as well. Communion comes from the Passover celebration, right? Jesus took the bread and wine of the Passover celebration, a Jewish feast, and imbued other meaning into it, and he used similar metaphors. But the metaphor in the Hebrew context, the metaphor in the Passover meal, is one of liberation from slavery, of being set free. So as we come to communion this morning, we're really saying, God, I want to be free. And so we can come with these weaknesses, these issues in our lives, and say, I want freedom. I want your life. I want your love. And we come to a metaphor of sacrifice, right? This broken body of Jesus, which is the bread, the blood, the shed blood of Jesus, which is the wine or the grape juice. And really what we're coming to is this full acceptance, right? The cross, the crucifixion, is evidence to us that God is fully self-controlled in love. That God, nothing can deflect God away from love. That God just keeps coming on and on at us with love, love. No matter what we throw at God, love prevails, love comes through, even to the point of death and sacrifice. And so that kind of sacrifice is the epitome of love. It's the epitome of self-control, if you like. So many things deflect us from love. Patterns of behavior, urges, this, that, the other. Nothing deflects God. So we're coming to complete love. Complete love that can set us free. So let's bear that in mind as we take the bread and we drink the wine. Everybody here is welcome to do that. Okay, everybody's welcome not to do it as well. But everybody's invited. Everybody is loved. And everybody can be set free. So everybody is invited to take the bread and wine. Another thing we're going to do this morning, and we've been doing this throughout our series, is writing down things that we're going to let go of or we want to let go of. And there are some stations at the side with paper where you can write that down. And it might be a prayer that you want to say this morning. It might be an issue going on in your life that's confidential. You can just write it down, tear it up or screw it up and just drop it in the basket. We're going to use that paper to make something in the final week of the series. So all shall be revealed. But that's a private moment, obviously. We have people at the back who would love to pray with you. We have places at the side towards the back where you can write out a prayer. If you've come with a burden or something you want to share, we just ask, don't go away on your own. Share it with somebody. God is here. God is present in us, in our people, and beyond that too. And we're going to sing songs together. And this is an opportunity for us, again, just to open our hearts to God and to God's love. So let's take full advantage of this moment. I'm going to pray, and then please come forward and take the bread and wine. Lord, we open our hearts to you. King of the universe, and yet full of love, full of compassion. One who can set free because you love so perfectly. Lord, we come to you now. Thank you for this bread and wine that represents something we will probably never fully understand. But as we attempt to, as we enter in, Lord, let your love overwhelm us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Please come forward.
In the conflicts, in the moon.